Welcome to a Prevent Connect podcast, where we explore the prevention of violence against women. This is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. The following presentation takes place at the 2010 Forum for Primary Prevention Advocates called Ending Violence Against Women and Teen Dating Violence. Keynote speaker Dr. Clee McNeely from the Center for the Study of Youth and Political Violence in the Department of Public Health at the University of Tennessee breaks down the teen years as they relate to the prevention of teen dating violence.
So when I was getting ready, I started looking up some data on teen dating violence. And as it's been mentioned four or five times, and I'll probably mention four or five more times to CYA, as they say, I am not an expert in teen dating violence. So I looked up the statistics, and you guys can educate me. But I found some interesting things that I then applied my perspective to, and that's what I want to share. I found that across national data sets, 20 to 30% of teens report psychological, emotional, or physical abuse in the past year in a romantic or sexual relationship. And this parallels the rate for interpersonal violence outside of romantic relationships, which I'm not equating the two. I'm just saying that this rate parallels. This data is based on self-report. I found one study in which they had teen couples in a room, and they gave them a problem to solve, and they videotaped the problem. And afterwards, they watched the videos, and they coded for, in this case, physical aggression, slapping, hitting, pushing, shoving. And they found that 51% of the teens engaged in some kind of physical aggression during that problem-solving task. This is really prevalent, and it's really exciting to see a room full of people who are really committed to working on this. I also looked at the data, and you guys may be very familiar with this, but I looked at the data on who's perpetrating. And what's really interesting, I looked at what girls were saying, what boys were saying, and what external observers were saying. No matter who's talking, it's very consistent. And in this study done by Peggy Giordano, she did a cohort study in Toledo, Ohio. She is one of my favorite researchers of romantic relationships among teens. In this study of about 1,400 7th, 9th, and 11th graders, about half of both boys and girls said that both boys and girls participate in physical aggression within the relationship. 30% of girls, 47% of boys said that girls were physically aggressive, and the boys did not respond. And then a small percentage of each group said that the boys were physically aggressive and the girls did not respond. Now remember, I'm not talking about the kind of aggression that is going to land someone in the emergency room. I'm talking about full spectrum of physical aggression. Very similar story on Long Island in Suffolk County. This is high school students, 9th to 12th graders. And in this study, it was identical what boys and girls were saying. Two-thirds said that both boys and girls participated. Again, this is in physical aggression. Just over a quarter said that it was the girls only, and 5% said boys only. We also know that from the observations, it's the exact same story. So that 51% of kids who were engaged in physical aggression, they also coded, well, who's doing the aggression? And again, about 60% it was mutual, a third was girls, and 8% boys. So both boys and girls are being physically aggressive. But the reasons for physical aggression are both the same and different. So both boys and girls are reporting anger. Boys are much more likely to say it was to exert control of the situation or of the person. And girls are much more likely to say that they were physically aggressive in self-defense. And we also know, this is very well documented, and you probably talked about it yesterday, that girls have more severe negative consequences from teen dating violence, both emotional and physical, from what we know. The other thing I was really struck about was the sparsity of the research. There's not much out there. As I was presenting you this data, I talk about physical aggression, I talk about teen dating violence, and I thought, okay, I have to cue myself in. How is teen dating violence defined? What are we talking about? It's showing up in different ways. People are using different measures. This is a standard definition of dating violence, which I have seen applied to teens. It's a type of intimate partner violence. It occurs between two people in a close relationship The nature of dating violence can be physical, emotional, or sexual. A definition that's familiar to everybody. But I was thinking about this in the context of teenagers. When you're a teenager, what does it mean to be an intimate partner? Okay. What does a close relationship look like? And what does it look like when teens engage sexual, physical, and emotional violence? We know that teen violence in general peaks in middle school, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. But that kind of violence is not the same kind of violence that those who persist and are still being violent in 12th grade. Middle school is like preschool violence, much of it, when you don't have emotional self-regulation and you communicate physically. I mean, that's part of the story. And you also, 72%, well, this was in the mid-90s, but the data hasn't changed that much, that 72% of 8th and 9th graders date. And some of the data I'm reporting comes from the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, which was done in the mid-90s, and it asks a lot of sexual violence, sexual behavior questions that we just don't have good national data on. And then we went through the Bush years, which I'm not commenting on, except to say that there was very little data collected on sex nationally during those years. So we often have to rely on older data. But 72% of 8th and 9th graders date. Wow. What does it mean to date when you're in 8th grade? And I'm so excited. I just got a little sister, you know, big brothers, big sisters. And I just got a little sister. She's 11 years old, and she would die if she knew I was talking about her. I started seeing her 2-3 times a week in June, and my boyfriend and my ex-boyfriend, and I'm going, okay, be calm. I do not know what this means, be calm. And I take her to Twilight Eclipse, and you cannot imagine my relief when she was like, ooh, kissing, you know? And I discover, gently through conversations, that having a boyfriend means sitting together on the bus. It means maybe a peck on the cheek. And it means mostly that incredible excitement when they're around, and maybe they feel it too. And there's a lot of social proclamation, which is what I was getting, right? A lot of identity formation in terms of just the fact of having a boyfriend, right? We also know that there's interpersonal violence happening between boys and girls at this age. So the main point of what I want to talk about today and just get us all to think about, and I don't have the answers, and I'm really excited about the breakout because if I can't imagine, you know, if you want to bear with me an entire morning, I'm not sure, but if you come to the breakout, I don't have an agenda. We can just talk about, bring my knowledge of development and your knowledge of your programs and talk about how to put them together, because I would love to learn from that. But anyway, my argument here today is that an understanding of teen dating violence, I think, should take into account teens' developmental capacity to understand and regulate emotions, theirs and others. It's different than adults. Their developmental capacity for empathy. What are other people feeling? How might their actions have an effect on someone else? Their capacity for that is different from adults. Profoundly inexperienced in relationships. And teens have equal economic power in relationships. So that dynamic is different, with the very major and very important exception of younger girls who are dating older guys. And the list of bad things that happen when girls date guys who are 4 or more years older, some say 3 or more years older, is very long, very, very long. It's not a good thing. The incredible importance of peers during adolescence and peer influences, and the incredible importance of adults. So one of the biggest myths out there, you know that flat teen affect, right? You got the iPod buds, right? Right. And then the friends come along and they're alive and they're excited and they're, you know, you don't get that as the adult or the parent, right? You do all the work and you get the, right? So we interpret that with our adult brains as saying we're not wanted, and they would just assume we went away. And too often we accommodate. And adults are incredibly important. And study after study shows, and the media somehow seems to continually be surprised, that teens incredibly value what their parents think. Believe it or not, but please believe it, most teens want to spend more time with their parents. Teens talk about their parents as role models when they're asked who's a role model, or they talk about how they wish their parents could be a role model. And all of us who are the village, the big sisters, and all of you in the young people you work with are also incredibly important. And a major area of my research is on teacher-student connectedness and connection and the incredibly powerful role that those adults have in young people's lives. So all of those are different than the adult paradigm. Okay. I also want to comment that this applies, the data I just presented, in no way to me argue for a gender-neutral framework. Okay, that I look at, I'm not highlighting gender today, I'm highlighting development, but I look at gender in everything I do. I think we need to. But this developmental perspective can be applied to whether you have a gendered or a gender-neutral framework. I'm not going to wade into that today. Okay, so I wrote this book, The Teen Years Explained. Here's the book. You can get a free downloadable copy. I have the source at the end of the slides. You'll get the emailed source. It's free. It's downloadable. You can print it in color, black and white. If you do buy it, it's available on Amazon.com. I don't make a penny. All of the money. This was funded, thank you very much, by the CDC and the Maryland Department of Health. And because it was funded by a grant, I don't get any money from this. This was part of my job to do this. And the money goes for developing and giving training and curriculum about this topic. So what's the purpose of the book? It's to explain in plain English. Please forgive me. I'm going to do a little promo for 3 minutes. It's to explain in plain English the science behind adolescent development. And it's to challenge and empower adults to invest more time in young people and to hopefully empower adults to feel more comfortable and confident working with young people. And the best compliment we got from the book itself was we had, okay, this is, you know, imagine combining your academic bureaucracy with your federal government bureaucracy with your state bureaucracy, because the Maryland State Health Department also contributed to this. So this was a long gestational age, shall we say, in this book. And but we had tons and tons of input. And the best input of all was the young person who said, I feel understood. It is respectful of young people. So it originally started when we had a request. I was with the Center for Adolescent Health at Johns Hopkins, a CDC-funded prevention research center. And we had a request from the Maryland Mentoring Partnership to update a guide on adolescent development, and they said there was a need. And so this became my responsibility, and I said, I can't believe there's nothing out there. I just can't believe that this is needed. And I had my staff go look, and we looked at hundreds of different materials, and they were all, almost all, how to survive your child's adolescence, right? And, you know, how to make it through, and then if the wheels fall off the bus, how to try to piece it back together. That's the entire paradigm of adolescence. And we wanted to describe normal, healthy adolescence, because most adolescents do make it, thank God, to adulthood. We all did, right? And we also wanted to tackle head-on some of the myths about adolescence. And here's just, myths and facts are always fun, so I'm throwing in a few. Teens think they are invincible, right? Risk takers think they're invincible, it won't happen to me. Whoops, excuse me, let me go back. In fact, teens assess certain risks better than adults do. Teens are better able to assess the risk of driving with a drunk driver. So this is kudos to health educators everywhere, right? Teens are better able to assess that risk than adults are. But it doesn't stop them from engaging in the behavior. And why, I'm going to talk about in a little bit. Teens only listen to friends. I've already talked about how adults matter. Adolescents live to push your buttons. In fact, for teens and adults view conflict differently, and I'll talk about this a little bit later too, that for teens with cognitive development, the thrill of hearing an adult say something that's wrong and then being able to correct them is an exhilarating experience. And it's not perceived by them necessarily as engaging. Here's my favorite. I was doing a talk in Rochester, New York. This is back in 2004. And I had a youth panel, and I said, okay, let's get together, get to know each other. I never like to put young people on the spot. I want them to know what we're going to talk about. I want to get their input, do all the positive youth development stuff. And I said, okay, let's sit. Let's put our chairs together in a circle and get to know each other. And so we did, and I said, great, nice circle. And some first thing out of her mouth, it's not a circle, it's an oval. And I was like, oh, good God. You know, and then I'm like, stop, you're the development person. Stop your emotional reaction, stop the desire to slap her across the face. Understand what's happening, right? Oh, and then finally, good self-esteem keeps teens away from risk behavior. This is one of the most entrenched scientific findings that will just not go away now that it's been shown not to be completely true. Self-esteem is very, very complicated. It is incredibly important for mental health. But what we have found is that risky behavior can bring social status. Popular kids are more likely to drink and smoke. And when you have self-esteem and you're popular, you're more likely, in some cases, to engage in risky behavior. And this is true, again, I'm not commenting on IPV, but this is true for violence, and particularly urban violence, that a lot of the high self-esteem kids are engaged in the most violence. Okay. So the book is structured. We have chapters on all the different areas of development. Physical development, sexual development, spiritual development. Well, it's one of the only books that covers spiritual development, identity formation, social emotional development, and cognitive development. We really try to emphasize the recent brain research, explaining how teen brains develop in each chapter. We have charts and graphs. So I'm not going to present this is what happens at this age today because you can download the book and look that up. We have sidebars and how-tos. So the guide was designed to be read in 5 minutes or 5 hours. It was designed for the magazine rack in that water closet in your house. So that when you only have a few minutes, you can still open it anywhere and hopefully get some good information. And we have standalone pages that are like the length of a magazine or a newspaper article about really kind of hot topics like sleep, bullying, effect of drugs on the teen brain, obesity, things like that. And through all of these chapters, we emphasize some themes. The first is this idea of positive youth development, this idea that when we as a public health community tend to focus on stopping and preventing problems, it's a very negative focus. What we found for young people is that often promoting healthy development has this whole host of positive consequences. And we kind of forget, as public health people, to have that focus. That this is Karen Pittman's bumper sticker phrase, adolescents are resources to be developed, not problems to be solved. And positive youth development, in a nutshell, is this idea that if you promote the 5 C's, these are things that all human beings are essential for all human beings to be developmentally fine, okay. Connection to others, competence, the ability to have mastery, to do something, caring, the ability to care and be cared for, character, and confidence. And if you go and wade into the youth development literature, like many literatures, you know, these are given like 47 different names, and it gets confusing. But the idea is very simple, and that when we provide these things in young people's life in as many arenas as possible, we really help encourage healthy development and help encourage healthy relationships, which is my understanding, important for intimate partner, preventing intimate partner violence. Okay. The other theme of the book is that adolescence is an amazing time of opportunity. So during adolescence, young people gain 50% of their adult weight. They become capable of sexually reproducing. And there is a spurt of brain growth and brain development that is unequaled at any time except infancy. So these enormous changes are happening during this time. And patterns get set during adolescence. Now, nothing's irrevocable. We're all changing throughout life. But a lot of patterns do get set during adolescence. The other theme which I've talked about is this idea that brain development impacts every area of development. It's not just hormones. A lot of it is just structural brain development. And this research is also very much in its infancy. But the stuff we're finding is very normalizing, I would say. It's very normalizing. It says like, oh, that's why teens are that way. It's normal. It's healthy. Maddening, maybe, but healthy. Okay. And then the other theme is that adults and settings matter. All of you matter a lot. Teachers, bus drivers, coaches. Physical development's going to happen. Physical development will happen. Other areas of development don't happen by themselves. Cognitive, social, emotional development, spiritual development, it takes a community to help promote that. The other theme is that out of sync is completely normal. And it could be that teens are out of sync with each other. My poor little sister at 11 years old, she's 12 in, let's see, 11 days. It's a very big deal. She's 12, but she's a size G in her bra size. I never knew they even made that size, right? And she's 11. She won't go swimming with me because she's so self-conscious. Her little best friend is Pancake, right? They're out of sync. That's normal. It's also normal that teens are out of sync within themselves. We're all familiar with this idea of a late bloomer or an early bloomer, but it can also be that you can be very socially adept and cognitively you haven't kind of kicked into gear yet. Or cognitively you're sharp as a tack and socially, this is my nephew, you're socially clueless, right? Within a kid, it's all normal, but it doesn't mean it's easy. It's not easy for adults, it's not easy for parents, it's not easy for teachers, it's not easy for the kids. And so this idea that out of sync happens, it's normal, and there's also the importance of what adults can do to help kids through that. So these are the main themes of the book. Oh, at the end of the book, we have profiles of development where we actually have vignettes of kids being out of sync and how adults can help. And mostly I just love those photos. That's why I put it out there. So what am I going to talk about today? I'm going to talk about brain development. I'm going to discuss the implications of brain development. I'm going to focus on cognitive, social, and emotional development because I think those are key areas for teen dating violence. Obviously, physical and sexual development are also, but I think this is an area that we don't think about as often, so I wanted to focus on today. And then throughout, just kind of throw out some ideas about working with kids, what adults can do. But you, all of you, are really the experts because you're doing the programs. I'm in my ivory tower. You're doing the programs. How does this information really, really can be applied? Okay, brain development. This picture shows the development of brain synapses in the first couple years of life. And what you see is this tremendous proliferation of neurons and then the dendrites, which are the things that connect the neurons and how they communicate with each other, how the neuron signals are sent. And that's called gray matter. And you have this massive production of gray matter. And we all, oops, sorry, some of the fonts got messed up when I put this here. But this is the nemesis of adolescent health people, Rob Reiner. And, you know, his 0-3 campaign. We now know, this is him saying in 1997, we now know First 3 years is the most critical time, and I love this last bit, but by age 10, your brain is cooked and there's nothing much you can do. And so this had the effect of sucking all of the funding out of older children. And I'm not against funding for younger children at all, but it basically pitted the two together. And why it's upsetting is that it's not true. And just 2 years after this talk, this really, really famous study came out of NIH, Dr. Geed. And what he had done is he had followed 145 kids, and he had put them through an MRI machine every 2 years and just documented their brain development to see what it looked like. And he found that there were actually two waves of this massive production of gray matter. Yes, one was the first 18 months of life, first 2 years of life, and the second one happened starting in early adolescence. And that each wave of this great production of gray matter, just, you know, the meat of thinking and being able to think, was followed by a reduction of gray matter or a pruning of gray matter. So it was produced, and then it was cut back. And the parts of the gray matter that we used the most were kept and made more efficient, and the parts of the gray matter that weren't used, I don't know the science of how it's pruned, if it just dissolves or what, I'm not sure, but that's pruned away. Obviously, there's not little clippers up there, right? And so we have gray matter and we have white matter. So the gray matter I talked about is the thinking portion of the brain, and the white matter is the insulation that goes on the neurons and then the communication between them. And that's called myelination. And it's a white matter, and it enhances efficiency. So here you have your neuron on the left, and then the figure on the right shows the myelination, or the white matter that starts surrounding your gray matter. Why is white matter important? White matter is like your bandwidth. So in terms of when you look at what neurons, the communication between neurons without the white matter and the communication of the neurons with the white matter, it's like increasing your bandwidth by 3,000 times. It just becomes quicker and more efficient. It's your processor. You've increased your RAM. You maybe haven't increased your memory, but you've increased your processing capacity, the speed and efficiency. So you can think faster. You can think more quickly. You can make quicker decisions. You can, very importantly, integrate what's happening in different parts of the brain. You can integrate thoughts and emotions. They can regulate each other better. So this is what's happening during adolescence. Here's another figure. On this figure, if you look at the brains on the top, the front of your brain is what's pointing down. So that's the front of your brain. And then the brains on the bottom, that's a bird's eye view. So that's the top of your brain that you're looking down. What this figure shows you is that you have that the development happens from the back to the front. So the blue is highlighting the development of the gray and then the white matter. So as it gets more blue, you have a more developed brain. So you show that it starts getting blue in the back and moves to the front. Okay, that's mildly interesting. What's in the front of your brain? That's your prefrontal cortex. That's your ability to cognitively process information. And that is develops later in adolescence. And we now know that it doesn't finish developing until, well, now the latest is age 24. It takes a long time. The other part of your brain that's developing is the callosum, which is what helps integrate information, and that's more in the back. So you have the capacity to cognitively understand and then to integrate information is what's developing later during adolescence. And so earlier in adolescence, they're processing their world with other parts of the brain. Not that they're not using this at all, but other parts were playing a more active role. So the prefrontal cortex, as I said, cause and effect, planning, and managing impulses. So remember, I said, yes, they can assess risks of driving with a drunk driver. How well do they manage an impulse to do it? Not so well. So let's talk about cognitive development. What's happening is this prefrontal cortex grows. There's a couple of key parts of cognitive development. One is the strengthened advanced reasoning skills. These are the what-if questions. What would happen if I got in a fight with my boyfriend? What would happen if I broke up with my boyfriend? What would happen if my boyfriend did that to me? And this capacity for hypothetical thinking through actions and consequences. You also have the capacity for abstract thinking skills, thinking about faith, love, trust, maybe political beliefs. This is a time of life when adolescents get very passionate about these things. Very passionate. Taking up the cause, at least this month, right? And there might be another cause next month. And then you also have the development of what we call metacognition, or the ability to think about thinking. What would happen if I stopped and think about this? It's pretty standard for adults. That's combining advanced reasoning with metacognition. That's a tough thing for early adolescents to necessarily do. So what you get out of this development of cognitive thinking is, as I mentioned before, teens are quick to point out inconsistencies between adults' words and actions, because this is a new discovery for them. So let's take a messy bedroom. There's a fight about a messy bedroom. The teen's view is, it's my bedroom. I'm in charge of it. I don't clean it up. And what does it matter to you anyway? The adults tend to have a much more moral perspective. You know, I don't ask you to do too much. You're not demonstrating responsibility, and you don't appreciate how easy your life is, right? So you have this conflict, because teens are processing that information as choice and freedom, and they just don't feel like it. And adults bring a completely different lens to this, that has much more abstract concepts like morality and responsibility and these kinds of things. Now, what's really interesting is that Larry Steinberg at Temple University has done research, and he's found that these kinds of adult-youth conflicts are much more distressing for adults than for teens. So we tend to how many of you are parents of teens and remember fights that you've had 2 or 3 years ago, right? Okay, we hang on to this stuff much more than teens do. Okay, so what can adults do? One thing is to just be patient while they test drive their new skills. Just hang on. And the maddening thing is that when you're the parent and they're just being absolutely haughty and awful to you, and then there's another adult in the car that gets all the, you know, I was just in this situation. I'm an aunt, and I was visiting my sister with her 14-year-old daughter, and she was just a B.I.T. you know what to her mom, and she was just fabulous with me. And her mom was so patient. Okay, never correct or put down adolescents. Even as they're correcting and putting you down, try to avoid that temptation. And don't take it to heart when they criticize adult opinions and behaviors. There's this great Mark Twain quote. It goes something like, you know, when I was 18, it was just amazing how much my father didn't learn, and by the time he was 20, I was 20. I was amazed at how much he had learned, something like that. Yeah, I butchered it. Sorry. Okay, ask open-ended questions. The worst thing one can do is, was it really stupid to, you know, was it a bad idea to drop out of the basketball team? Right. That's not helpful. What's helpful is to ask the kinds of questions that are going to promote cognitive thinking. Well, if you drop out of the basketball team, what might you do then? And just encouraging some what-if kind of cause and effect. What would happen? Nothing. Okay, try another tack. But don't say, was it a bad idea? Highlight the role of emotions in decision-making processes. And you can do this very, very concretely. Now, it's often bad to do it in the moment. What are you feeling right now, honey? You know, that's not good. But afterwards, going back, or another great way to do it is those, you know, when kids are younger and you're watching TV and out of the blue comes that sex question, right? And you're just totally not prepared for it. And this is mostly younger children. And then the moment's over. These kinds of moments also arise for teens talking about emotions and how to handle emotions. And simple things like, how did that make you feel? Just gets teens to have to try to name an emotion. And that's really helping their develop their capacities. And then focus on strengths that youth bring to the decision-making process. And it was nice to hear efforts being made to incorporate young people in decision-making process. And I would say that we, as adults, are generally not very, we're not very practiced or skilled in doing that yet. And I include myself in this. It's a hard thing to do. So I was at a planning meeting for a teen conference with the Knox Health Department, and they were going to do, they did this conference in March, and they had the youth, youth advisory committee, they had the youth advisory committee, and the youth advisory committee said, this is what we want to cover. So then I went to the team planning meeting, and I looked at the agenda, and it was a one-day conference, and they were going to have 13 topics with 13 speakers. And I thought, oh dear, how old are these kids? Where's the dancing? Where's the hip-hop? You're going to have 13 speakers? And they said, I know it's a lot, but this is what the young people said they wanted. And we really want to honor their decision-making. And so we're not really good at understanding developmentally, well, yeah, that's what they want. But they don't think through the implications of covering all those topics in a single day. So we tend to we tend to do youth decision-making as a little bit too one-shot. Like, give us your input and we will honor that because we respect young people and we want to honor that. Instead of having them continually involved in the minutiae of the planning and working with them to develop their cognitive skills. Okay, 13 topics. What do you think that's going to be like if we have 13 speakers? Right? That takes time and money. It always takes more money and transportation and energy and just a trusting of our own competence as adults to be able to question the young people while still recognizing that we're honoring them and respecting them. So I have trouble with it. I think a lot of people have trouble learning how to incorporate youth in decision making. Okay. And get youth actively practicing decision-making. This is along the same lines. Social and emotional development is really a quest for social and emotional competence. And what do I mean by that? Emotional competence is the ability to perceive, assess, and manage one's own emotions. What am I feeling? And what am I expressing about what I'm feeling? And social competence is the capacity to be sensitive and effective in relating to other people. What are you feeling? And how am I reacting to what you are feeling? And there's four pieces of this that I'd like to talk about. Self-awareness, what am I feeling? Social awareness, what are you feeling? Self-management, also called self-regulation by psychologists, but I find that an unattractive term. And peer relationships and how peer relationships play in, including dating relationships, play into social and emotional development. Okay, self-awareness. What do I feel? Like I say, learning to recognize and name emotions, and that doesn't mean I feel bad or I feel good, which is pretty easy for all of us to say, I feel really bad. It's much harder for all of us to say, wow, I feel anxious, I feel sad. And then to say, oh, I feel sad, why do I feel sad? And learning to name emotions. And then identifying the source of those emotions. Like I say, why am I feeling sad? These are prerequisites to helping with regulating what you're feeling. And regulating what you're feeling is a prerequisite to decisions about how you act on your feelings, which is why I'm talking about it. It occurs to me this is probably related to teen dating violence. Social awareness is what do other people feel. It's also known as empathy. And it's one of the cornerstones of social development. And what I think is really fascinating is that adolescents have a lot of trouble with social awareness. And so I want to show you.
I find that the quickest way to get shut out is to ask questions about things that you're not welcome to know or to share. So for me as a parent, it has always been more a matter of waiting for the oyster to open and being present when it does.
Dr. Deborah Yergeland Todd and her associate Stacy Gruber are scanning the brains of teenagers to see how they read emotion. The small but intriguing study at McLean Hospital near Boston is mapping differences between the brains of adults and teens.
I came to this research with the assumption that the teenager was going to look a lot like an adult. In fact, I assumed that the 13-year-old brain would respond quite similarly to the adult brain in terms of the kinds of tasks that we were asking them to do when they were in the magnet.
To explore this, Todd put teenage and adult volunteers through an MRI and monitored how their brains responded to a series of pictures.
Here we go. Ready? Ready.
The volunteers were asked to discern the emotion on these faces. The results were surprising.
One of the interesting things about the findings are that they suggest that the teenagers are not able to correctly read all the feelings in the adult face.
All the adults identified this emotion as fear, but the teenagers invariably saw something different.
Patrick, how you doing?
Okay.
Tell me about those faces. What were those faces feeling?
A lot of them were shocked or angry, and I think that was it.
Okay, shocked and angry.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
They see anger when there isn't anger, or sadness when there isn't sadness. And if that's the case, then clearly their own behavior is not going to match that of the adult. So you'll see a miscommunication, both in terms of what they think the adult is feeling, but also and then what the response should be to that.
The reason for this, she believes, is that teenagers use a different part of the brain to assess the emotion on people's faces.
This is a really nice picture highlighting the fact that in an adolescent brain, the relative activation of the prefrontal region, or this anterior front part of the brain, is less than it is in the adults. But in contrast to that, the more emotional region, or that gut response region, has more activation compared to the adult. So that the relationship between these two regions is very different. And we think that that's been a very important finding in terms of understanding adolescent behavior.
At Nikki Ellis's high school, students often feel that they are the ones who are misunderstood, not the other way around, with some exceptions.
When you're looking on the board here and you see you as central, how does your family factor into your life? I would like a picture of you.
No.
I don't want a mugshot, I want a picture, okay?
Patrick Knight is a popular teacher, often acting as a bridge between the students and adults. We ask Knight to gather a group of his students to find out what's on their minds.
What's a stereotype that's placed on teenagers' shoulders that bothers you?
That no matter what they're doing, they're always causing trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Everything they do will end up causing trouble in some
young
way.
Young and stupid.
Yeah.
Just that they think we're all liars. They think, yeah, I think, like, not even that we're liars, like, people, a lot of them, adults, think we're dumb.
Well,
like we don't know anything.
Exactly.
No, but not even that. Remember, you could be just walking. I've been standing beside adults. I've stood beside adults, and there could be just a girl or a guy walking. They don't look anyway. The guy doesn't have to be, he doesn't have on no bandanas or nothing. And they'll just, oh, look at them. I don't know why teens love to walk street and didn't.
My dad thinks that, like, I drink and I cause trouble. And he thinks that I'm always looking for ruckus and stuff. That's not true.
The funniest thing, though, is just, like, they think that we're dumb and that we're whatever. And then some of these people that have that attitude, and they've even said stuff to me, and some people, they are the biggest hypocrites I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I was just like, okay, like, be quiet. You know, like, look at yourself and then fix yourself up before you judge me.
The teenager is not going to take the information that is in the outside world and organize it and understand it the same way we do.
I'll just be sitting at home watching TV, and my mom will say, did you do that for me? I'll be like, oops, I forgot, sorry. You didn't forget. You chose not to do it.
Yeah, like,
you chose. You decided that you did not want to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Because if you wanted to do it, then you'd have done it right away.
My mom will fully, she'll say, oh, but you didn't forget to roam street. You didn't forget to go, oh, you didn't
exactly,
forget to
yeah, exactly.
In terms of interactions at the dinner table or on the weekend or doing chores or doing homework, it means that whatever communication, whatever conversation you had with them, if you're assuming they understood everything you said, they may not have, or they may have understood it differently.
The new ways of looking at the brain point scientists like Jay Geed to a different understanding of how it works.
The cerebellum in the back of the brain is the part of the brain that changes most during the teen years. So this part of the brain has not finished growing well into the early 20s even. The cerebellum used to be thought to be involved in the coordination of our muscles, but we now know it's also involved in coordination of our thinking processes. And just like one can be physically clumsy, one can be kind of mentally clumsy. And this ability to smooth out all the different intellectual processes, to navigate the complicated social life of the teen, and to get through these things smoothly and gracefully instead of lurching to adolescence, seems to be a function of the cerebellum. As a society, we're less active than we ever have been in the history of humanity. We're good with our thumbs and video games and such, but as far as actual physical activity, running, jumping, playing, children are doing less and less of that. And the recess and play seem to be the first thing that is cut out of school curriculums in tight times. But those actually may be as important or maybe even more important than some of the academic subjects that the children are doing.
This is a really great, on the PBS website, there's the Frontline did a series on the adolescent brain. I'm going to show another clip from it a little bit later. And so you can watch the whole series, and then they just have all kinds of written materials. So they're a great resource for both your thinking about stuff and also for teaching. And so a ways that adults can help is you can tell teens what you're feeling, because they may not recognize what you're feeling. So you think about that kid who said, my dad thinks I'm out causing trouble. Well, what might dad have really said? He might really think that. Or he might have said, I don't want you to hang out with those boys because those boys are causing trouble. Right? And or maybe he didn't say that, but he just showed some emotion, and the kid interpreted that. So being really clear about your reasoning and explaining your own emotions. So you come home, you say, I'm not angry, I'm just tired and crabby, and I need 10 minutes to myself. Right? Instead of thinking that they might understand that. And then it's also really important. So just as teens are not understanding adult faces and emotions, they're also miscuing on each other. Okay, so helping them to learn how to describe how they're feeling and practicing saying it, it's hard. We're not good as adults doing this. It's hard. But that can help them in their own relationships and not just teen-adult relationships. And over the arc of adolescence, of course, they get much more skilled in doing this. Okay. The other area of social and emotional development is managing. So being aware of others' emotions and your own emotions, and then managing emotions. And adolescents experience emotions intensely. They showed you on that MRI that lower part, that's the amygdala of the brain, and that lights up a lot more in these functional MRIs when kids are are experiencing emotions or processing things. So they're processing things much more emotionally. So here's another little clip. Gotta go back to the last one. I was so committed to not being one of these old people that don't
have the
technology.
Boredom, one-word answers, the misery. You know, it always looks a lot more humorous to us in retrospect.
At the old carousel in Riverside, Rhode Island, Brittany Husnander and her friend Leah Kroll ride around just as they did when they were kids. But now the thrills are elsewhere.
So what happened last night? Did you guys, like, kiss or anything?
Nope.
Why not?
Because why? I don't know if I want to.
Why not?
I don't know.
Okay.
How come you wouldn't give him an answer, Leah? I want you to go out with him.
Then why do you make it so complicated?
There's nothing to do in Riverside. It's so boring. We just walk around. That's all we ever do is, like, walk around. Or, like, I don't know. We barely even do anything. We go to the beach sometimes. Sometimes we go to the mall. Sometimes we go to the movies. But pretty much all we do is sit around and just, like, talk, go in the pool or whatever. It's boring.
Brittany can change from fed-up teen to focused artist very quickly. She's a good student with many talents and a lot of support from the teen expert in her house, her mother, Beverly.
They're trying to make the best way they can. They're trying to put the pieces together the best way they know how. And on top of it all, they're going through this hormone thing and peer pressure and all this other stuff.
Bev is sympathetic to the ups and downs of teenage life. She is easy about Brittany's swings in mood, able to tolerate a lot of teenage angst.
Now she's aggravated. Can't do nothing right these last 2 days. I wonder whose fault that is.
God bless the guy who's willing to take her on, because he's going to have to be a very open and comfortable person with females rather than being intimidated by them.
No, he didn't!
Brittany's not going to be intimidated by her brother, Brandon.
You're not going to deny that they flirt with me, too. So why aren't you mad at them? That's why I get mad at Leah. I don't get mad at you because Leah always sits in your room with you and follows you guys and talks to you guys. I don't get mad at you. I get mad at Leah. So why are you mad at me? Get mad at your friends. Tell your friends to stay the f*** away from me.
Did I say anything?
I swear to God, I'm never talking to any of your friends
you
again. I'll never talk to you again. I swear
you don't
to
have
God.
To stop talking to us. You
they
can
leave.
Talk, but the
Brandon,
way...
What am I not supposed to live in my own house? Do you hear more than I am?
You live on Mike.
I swear to God, I'll be like, Mike, you need to move. I live here, and there's no other seats on the couch, so I need to lay down. Get up.
You don't see me doing it to your friends whenever someone goes, want to go to Bucky's. You don't see me go, yeah, I'll go with you. I'll take the walk. Oh, man, let's go.
I'm sorry.
Bev Husnander remains unperturbed. She knows it could all pass in a moment.
Give me a hug. You didn't hug me. I hugged you.
Okay, that's good enough.
No, give me a hug. Thank you.
We think that the dramatic changes in mood, for example, a child having an outburst at one moment and then being very calm and happy the next, is due in part to changes in hormones, because we know that as a child enters puberty, these changes in mood are much more dramatic. And as a year or two after puberty has begun, things level down a little bit. But we think the ultimate responsibility for regulating these mood changes resides in the frontal cortex, and that's what's overseeing this whole operation.
Jim Borgman, a parent himself, recalls his own teenage mood swings with great clarity.
Remembering those years and how they felt and how insecure we were and how vulnerable we felt and the sadness and the loneliness and the confusion and the isolation. The strip is intended to be funny, and I hope it is, but there has to always be that underlying layer of the sudden touch you have as a teenager with the deep well of human experience.
Nicole Ellis often feels vulnerable, but today the picture she's trying to portray is of the self-assured Nicole, the one who is running for student council at a Toronto high school.
I've been attending the school for the past 2 years and noticed the lack of interest taken to make the school more exciting. That's why I'm running for social convener. One of the things I'd like to bring back to you is our school dance.
Today the students will give her a vote of confidence.
It's your school, embrace it. Thank you.
But for a teenager, confidence is something clutched at, seldom held.
1 hour I could be really happy and laughing, then the next hour I'm just really, really upset. Then it could be one whole day I'm fine, then 2 days later I'm just mad.
It's funny, but it's like...
Nikki lives with her mother and two brothers.
Upsy-daisy, come on.
Her mother Gail knows the turbulence of the teenage years.
I know her moods. I know when something is bothering her. I know when she feels she doesn't want to talk. And I know when there's a time to just leave her alone. And I also know when there's a time to find out what's bothering her ASAP. I sort of have to feel her out.
I give you those.
Sometimes I just don't feel like talking, period. And then she knows. She knows that, so.
But like, are you feeling angry inside, confused? What? And that's what she wants to
know? I don't even know. Sometimes I don't even know.
She doesn't
even know why I'm upset. I'm just upset.
She comes to me sometimes. She says, Mom, I feel like crying. So I sit down, put her in my arms, and let her cry.
The recent work on brain development, in my mind, enormously helps explain things that we've known for some time in child development. So people who've studied adolescence for many years have pointed to these changes in behavior that we've been describing, these changes in mood and fluctuations in mood and the like, without quite being able to pinpoint what was responsible for those changes. And now I think we have a much better handle on that. And I think my argument would be that it's the changes going on in the frontal cortex that gradually give the child the ability to regulate those powerful emotions, solve problems more effectively, to be more planful in their behavior. So what's really new here is our ability to explain the child development work that we've known about for quite some time.
So again, ways adults can help. The idea is that emotions can and should be managed. We all need to learn how to do that. And this is, I think, a bit redundant of what I've said. It involves using their critical thinking skills and their abstract thinking skills. And these are the skills that allow someone to step back, examine their emotions, and consider how they bear on longer-term goals. Okay, let's get to peers. Here come the peers. Decisions about how to act and how to behave are often taken in the context of peers. And there was this really interesting study that was done where they had teens, college students, and adults. And they put them in one of like these video arcades, and they put them in one of these race car driving arcades, and they measured how much risky driving they did. So who did the riskiest driving? The adults? Probably teens. Same. They all took equal amounts of risk. Then they brought in the peers. So the teens were with their friends, the college students were with their friends, and the adults had their friends around them in this video arcade. Who took the most risk? Twice as much. Their risky driving doubled. The teens' risky driving doubled. The adults didn't change. And the college students were halfway in between. And actually less than that. It went by 50% instead of 200%. So that what's happening is that social acceptance is very rewarding for teenagers. It's extremely emotionally rewarding. And there seems to be something about taking risk in the presence of peers that becomes very rewarding. And so the follow-up study was done by Larry Steinberg, the same guy who did the study on the conflict. And he, again, did a functional MRI while they were doing these activities. And the brain scan showed that teens responded differently with friends. And so, again, the emotional reward center of their brain lit up more when they were driving in front of friends, suggesting it's emotionally rewarding. They've done these similar kinds of studies with gambling, showing that taking bigger risks is more rewarding for teens than adults in that gambling. So helping teens here's a take-home message. Helping teens understand that something is risky does not necessarily lead to a behavior change, right? Then, and understanding the role that peers play, how teens respond to peers, and that it may be a function of brain activity, not a function of willpower or maturity, it is maturity, obviously. I think it's really important for thinking through interventions and how we expect teens to respond. And then also establishing social status. I mentioned this before, that risky behavior often can help kids establish social status only when that risky behavior is normative and is valued, right? So what's a risky behavior that's not normative, not valued, seen as delinquent? Stealing, right? Yeah, stealing. So you might be with a group of peers who egg you on to steal, but you're not going to steal as a way to get status, except maybe in that peer group, but not more broadly so. So, however, being an early adopter of alcohol, trying cigarettes early, in certain settings, sexual activity increases your popularity. In other settings, it doesn't. And in certain settings, acting really tough and macho for boys is a very rewarding experience. It may not be their value system. It may not be in their family. They may not even feel comfortable doing it when they're doing it. So I'm really giving the boys the benefit of the doubt here. But it may be incredibly rewarding socially. And Stephen Pollack's done a lot of work on this, and he works with more clinical samples of kids. But he has shown that boys are more likely to engage in masculine norms in front of their friends. And simultaneously, both boys and girls worry very much about being humiliated in public, which makes me wonder, and again, you're the experts, but it makes me wonder to what extent that aggression in relationships, we need to think about it among teens, not just as a private behavior, but as a public behavior. And is that what you're finding? Because I would suspect that violence among dating partners occurs with peers around, right? And that is, I would suspect, again, a difference with adults. And that has, I think, big implications for how we all think about it. Okay, and again, I'm sorry the fonts got kind of messed up when I put it on this computer, but I also want to emphasize that peers are really positive. Peers are developmentally essential. They're learning how peers are how friendships and peers is how we learn to have relationships. And friendships and peers is how we learn to have intimate relationships, generally before we go on to romantic or dating relationships. So they're very important. There's also a lot of really good research showing all the positive effects of peers. And then also, just because we do see a surge in peer influence and the importance of peers does not mean, and I'm getting on my soapbox here, but it does not mean the importance of adults wanes. For teens, a romantic relationship may or may not have anything to do with a physical sexual relationship. And, like adults, vice versa, you can have a sexual relationship that's not romantic. But this idea of romantic relationships not having a sexual component, I think, is more unique to teens. So romantic relationships, they can be short-lived. It can be a day, a week, or they can be permanent and everlasting love. The interest may not be mutual. When you ask romantic partners when in school-based samples, you're asked to nominate a romantic partner, and you're given a list of all the kids. If I nominate you, and then we look at the data, it doesn't mean you've nominated me. Now, they may not also be reciprocal among adults, but it's more likely to have unreciprocated romantic relationships in youth. And like I said, they may not involve physical intimacy, even kissing, which doesn't mean they're not emotionally incredibly potent and doesn't mean there aren't opportunities for dating violence to happen. Sexual relationships, I don't think those need quite as much definition. Like I said, they may or may not be romantic. They may be short-lived. They may be long-lived. The age differential is a big, big issue. That when girls are dating boys or men who are 3 or 4 or more years older, usually those aren't the ideal kinds of partners because you have men who are looking for someone who's less powerful and less mature than they are. And you have someone who's just in awe of this incredible person that has chosen them. I'm being very stereotypical here, but you can kind of get the idea. And it's associated with much greater rates of intimate partner violence, much greater rates of sexual abuse, much greater rates of unprotected sex, STDs, and unwanted pregnancy, and also psychological and emotional consequences. So that's something that should really be discouraged. Sexual relationships also involve the negotiation of safe sex. So that has this whole different component that a romantic relationship may or may not have. Okay, so I also wanted to talk a little bit about the enormous variability in romantic and sexual relationships across the teen years. And this is just a slide that gives you some stats. And by ninth grade, this is according to CDC-funded YRBS data, Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance Survey data, males by ninth grade, you know, roughly 38% of boys, this is 2007 data, 27% of girls have had sex. And by 12th grade, that's reached 60%. And the median age of first sex is the same for boys and girls now. It's 16.7, meaning by just under 17 years, approximately 50% of boys and girls have had sex. So you can look at this two ways. One is that's a lot of sex. And the other is most teens wait until later adolescence. Basically, what's happened is later ages at first sex. So in 91, this is a little bit different way we've set out the data, but in 1991, 51% of girls and 57% of boys in high school, 9th through 12th grade, said they'd had sex. And that number had fallen to 46% by females and 50% of boys by 2007. So age of sex is rising. Age of first sex is rising. And number of partners is decreasing. And now there's been a little blip. So from 1986 to, this is the area I know about. Thanks for asking. From 1986 to 2005, all of the indicators of reproductive sexual risk were going in the right direction. So later age of first sex, fewer abortions, fewer pregnancies, more contraception. Okay. In 2005, things have now started going in the other direction, and we're not sure whether this is just a little blip or things are truly going in the other direction. So, and I'd be happy to talk about that further at any time, but I think I need to stay on topic here. So dating also has a lot of positives. And dating, again, is how young people learn how to have intimate relationships. And through dating, you experience these incredibly intense emotions of happiness, excitement, disappointment, and despair, and you learn how to handle them. And you go through those experiences. It's very important to have support as you're going through all of that. And that both boys and girls value emotional intimacy in romantic relationships. And this is really, again, really good work by Peggy Giordano at Ohio, where she did these amazing qualitative interviews with boys about how much they value intimacy and trust within romantic relationships, but how they could never admit that to their male peers. And they actually report feeling that very vulnerable to women emotionally. Just as girls have traditionally reported, but more publicly so, feeling very vulnerable emotionally to boys. So that's really, really interesting. And Liz Miller, who's your good friend and couldn't be here today, she's also done some fabulous work in this area. And she did a study, I think, in Davis. She went and talked to middle school kids, and 100% of the kids she talked to said that possessiveness and jealousy are a part of true love. 100%. And this is a quote from a New York Times article that she was in. She said, most teens don't understand what a healthy relationship is, often mistaking the controlling behaviors that characterize abuse for signs of love. Where might teens be getting these messages? Does anyone else find these series of movies absolutely terrifying? I mean, I think it's different for those who read the books. They see the movies differently. But for those, and most young girls have not read the books, who see the movies, the messages of possessiveness and obsession, and that that's what true love is, I find absolute loss, lack of empathy for how this might affect family and friends. Basically, she has this obsessive relationship with a vampire where when he tries to break up with her to help her, she doesn't eat or talk to her parents or talk to her friends, and she's just totally emotionally irresponsible for 8 months until he comes back, or some many, many months, I can't remember. And that's okay. That's a sign of love, right? And then you have him who's essentially stalking her, is in her room when she's not there, and sees the dream weaver and gets jealous, right? That's hanging on her bed that the other boy gave her. That stalking behavior, that is true love, right? But this is presented as a positive movie because they wait to have sex. So these movies make me crazy. This is the popular media that we are showing teens and adults who are supposed to mentor teens, right? What can adults do? We can model healthy romantic relationships ourselves. This is probably one of the most important things we can do. Explain what healthy relationships look like. Have a conversation about eclipse, which I haven't dared broach with my little sister, by the way. This is hard stuff, you know, to burst that bubble. Again, help teens work on skills to identify their own emotions and resolve conflicts in their relationships. This is a tall order. This is tough stuff. In conclusion, and I want to leave a couple minutes for questions, my goal here is to talk about how some of the areas of development might be applicable to you. I hope that some of the information on brain development, social-emotional development, cognitive development, importance of adults, also this idea that it's really important, and this is an incredibly well-researched piece of information, to have and promote healthy development in as many contexts as possible. The idea is, if you get it at home, we don't have to do it at school. In fact, we shouldn't do it at school, right? Or if you get it at school, you can compensate for the fact that it's not at home. And in fact, kids need it everywhere. And the more places, the better. These effects are absolutely additive. The more places, the better. And again, just reiterating, thinking about how these might in particular relate to teen dating violence, the capacity to understand and regulate one's own emotions and understand and empathize with others, profound inexperience in relationships at the beginning of adolescence and gaining experience during that time, not having these traditional economic disequilibriums in relationships and how that might play into it, the incredible importance of peer influence and how that may even take teen dating violence into the arena of a public behavior, and adult influences and what we all can do as adults. And finally, I need to say that because we know a lot about the structure of the brain And because we know a lot about what lights up in the brain when kids do certain things, does not mean that we can extrapolate from brain function to individual behaviors. And it doesn't give us a reason to discount young people. Oh, it's just their brains, they can't help it. It doesn't give us a reason to discount adults. You just gotta wait for the brain to grow up. And in a real sense, it doesn't teach us anything that grandma didn't already know, but I think it helps us normalize and reframe as normal and healthy things that have been talked about as abnormal and unhealthy.
Thank you for listening to this Prevent Connect podcast. Prevent Connect is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. To learn more about Prevent Connect, visit www.preventconnect.org. For more information about CalCASA's mission or to show your support, visit calcasa.org. That's CalCASA.org.